Are you ready for the quantum age?
Humanity's next step in evolution?
Dream Vision 7 Radio Network invites you to the extraordinary platform of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age.
Let's explore. Learn more about this upcoming age where we bridge science with spirituality.
Where potentiality meets reality.
Where we take compassion into action.
Our trailblazers and visionaries will ask the whys, the what ifs, while igniting continuous possibility.
Come along with us into an age beyond what we know today, where we can grow together in unity consciousness.
Experience Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on DreamVision7Radio.com.
Welcome to another edition of Islands of Sanity. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. Someone has said that we are swimming in the soup of a collectively traumatized humanity. You know, this is about more than just counting the things we have to worry about in 2020 and beyond. This is about ecosystems that are dying, water that is becoming undrinkable, air that is becoming unbreathable, species that are going extinct faster than we can track their extinction, climate chaos everywhere, millions of climate refugees, massive economic inequality, and I could obviously continue ad infinitum. All of these gargantuan realities overwhelm us daily, whether we're consciously aware of them or not. My guest today stopped talking about climate change in 2019 and is now speaking almost exclusively of climate trauma. He is Zhiwa Woodbury, and the first name is spelled Z-H-I-W-A, pronounced Zhiwa, Zhiwa Woodbury, and he's an earth advocate, an eco-attorney, an eco-psychologist, and author of Climate Sense, Changing the Way We Think and Feel About Our Climate in Crisis. While he and I may not agree on every single aspect of our planetary predicament, I consider Zhiwa an ally and a soul brother in the daunting task of navigating territory that humans have never before experienced. Zhiwa Woodbury, welcome to Islands of Sanity.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's always wonderful to be marooned on an island of sanity with you.
Yeah, I know. I love it. So in Eco-Psychology Magazine, March 2019, your article, Climate Trauma Toward a New Taxonomy of Trauma, was published in which you argued that we should move beyond talking about climate change and start talking about climate trauma. And more recently, you posted an article on Medium.com entitled The Religious Fervor That Sets Extinction Rebellion Apart from 350.org and the American Environmental Movement. In that Medium article, it seems that you're asking us not only to deal with our personal and cultural trauma, but that no matter how much we do so, we must develop an intimate relationship with Gaia. And in the article you say, quote, because Gaia is by definition superhuman, her trauma is by definition a superordinate form of trauma, meaning that it's over and above and constantly triggering all other forms of trauma, cultural, generational, epigenetic, and individual. While it's important to me to first present this theory in a peer-reviewed academic journal, and while I'm heartened by its widespread acceptance and appreciation, I have come to see the importance of referring to this biospheric assault at every opportunity as Gaia's trauma. The reason for this switch in terminology is that I have become convinced that until we come to grips with the reality of this superior organism, we will not be able to come into proper relationship with her, which is to say, with the natural world, unquote. And so my question for you, Zhiwa, is what did you mean by the religious fervor that sets Extinction Rebellion apart?
Wow. There's an awful lot. That triggered an awful lot in me, right all the way back to the admonition against using the term climate change, which is actually a fine scientific term, but not appropriate for talking about what we're experiencing. So because of that paper, actually, which before we go on, I mean, even though you attribute that paper, I authored that and published it and stuff, you know, and I know that theory of climate trauma was actually something that we collaboratively developed in these conversations. And so I just want to shout out to that. You know, it was one of the more recent, we had two, I think, conversations about climate trauma before I wrote that paper. And those conversations were so helpful to me in formulating the idea, especially because you were out there in the field running the idea by professionals and so forth, which mm-hmm. I'm not in a position to do always. So I just want to start there because I think it's appropriate to properly attribute something, and I don't want to be guilty of appropriation. I am guilty of appropriation all the time, but I at least want to call myself out on that.
I appreciate that.
So after I published that paper, word kind of spread, and one thing leads to another. I mean, these things are, there's no such thing as coincidence in the world. I mean, that's part of recognizing that Gaia as a living organism is how she calls us, you know, how she calls us forth to witness or testify or whatever feel. And so one thing led to another, and I've been following Greta since she was by herself. You know, I remember seeing that story very early on when she started that lonely protest, and then Extinction Rebellion, you know, when they got off the ground, just coincidentally again, she was there and gave them a good boost, and that movement shook Europe, you know, London and England and Europe in a way that I, as a lifelong eco-activist, have never really seen, but always wanted to see here in the U.S., right?
Yeah.
So a journalist contacted me from the, of all papers, the Financial Times of London, which it turns out is really a misleading name. It's just a really old paper, but it's much like our New York Times. I learned. Yeah. I didn't know that then. At first, I was thinking, oh, is this like the Wall Street Journal or something?
Right.
But this reporter, Matthew Green, was doing a feature length story for their Sunday magazine, I think, on Extinction Rebellion. Mm-hmm. So he called me and to interview me ostensibly, but I don't know if you have this experience too with people. The interview kind of quickly turned into a therapy session, you know, and because so many of these journalists are experiencing despair, the more they get into the story, the more they're realizing the magnitude of their coverage and the inappropriateness or in sort of like they're not quite equipped to deal with journalists with these kind of stories, you know? Yeah. And so it causes them to question a lot. And anyways, he did a wonderful story on Extinction Rebellion. And I was really heartened by the fact that he quoted Joanna Macy in there quite a bit it was a good story. But more importantly, we struck up a relationship and he started introducing me to people involved in the sort of intellectual sort of thinking behind the Extinction Rebellion. And so somehow I got drawn into from across the seas, you know, Extinction Rebellion, you know, I'm not taking any credit at all, of course, but rather just having an inside perspective on their thought processes, where, you know, the story, their backstory, and you know, things like that. And it started really giving me a lot of perspective, and I recognized right off that the reason that they were having a more profound effect on the cultural sphere, and of course, the people who don't know, I mean, you know, they prompted the government in short order to declare a climate emergency in Ireland and in England. They got the last prime minister to actually commit to decarbonizing the economy. And actually just yesterday, Boris Johnson, of all people, came out and said that he wants to take a strong leadership role in the world to resuscitate the Paris Accords, and they're having the COP26 there in London. Mm-hmm. That's kind of shocking. So I think, you know, it's clear that Extinction Rebellion has had a really profound effect on people. And what I noticed in what I sort of realized was it was because it wasn't just a political issue to them. It wasn't, you know, it was something very personal. The people that started Extinction Rebellion were successful professionals, basically, who walked away from their careers and said, this is an emergency and the future's at stake and I'm going to act like it. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of the adults that Greta Thunberg has been sort of asking for all along and wondering why people weren't acting like the climate that we were facing, existential crisis, you know? Like, she's makes that point in her TED video. And so these people were the ones that I saw are acting like that. And so the religious fervor, you know, I mean, I go into detail in the paper about what I mean by that, but it's basically that this is a political issue, but it's not a political issue. You know what I mean? It's like, it certainly has political dimensions. We certainly have to somehow shake our governments free of the pernicious influence of money and corporate power in order to survive. But it's so much more than a political issue. It's so much more than a personal issue. It's all of that, you know, and it's more. And so part of it was like that leaving your career behind is what sort of like people did in the Crusades, you know. You leave your life behind because there's something, or what our, you know, my father, you know, did in World War II in his generation, you know, like they left even the possibility of life behind as young men because there was something calling to them that was of a sort of religious dimension, you know, the way we understand religion, a universal sort of struggle. And that's the attitude that the folks from Extinction Rebellion had. And their approach sort of mirrors that and reflects that. But I don't want to underplay this as well. You know, also the higher sensibilities of religion, like art, you know, like religion and art have always been intimately involved. And art and performance and appealing to people at sort of the level of archetypes, you know, with imagery and, right, you know, the pink boat that they use to block the intersection, yeah, you know, and floating a house down the River Thames, you know, like these kind of actions that are intended to pierce the sort of veil of public consciousness in a way that politics is not really able to, also has a religious dimension. But then finally, this has been really interesting to me from the start, and a lot of us are still sort of grappling with it, but there is definitely a movement afoot, parallel but intersecting with Extinction Rebellion, where people are finding safe ways of experiencing entheogenic substances. And entheogenic substances are is a religious, the reason they're called entheogens instead of hallucinogens or drugs, they're called medicine instead of drugs, is because they induce a religious type of experience. And people like Sting, for instance, become incredibly attuned to the living vitality of the earth, that connection that they have to it, and become very active. It's a life-altering experience instead of a mind-altering experience. And like Sting, for instance, when the first time he did ayahuasca in the jungles of South America, he became a full-on committed environmental activist from that day forward. And so he kind of, so I've been aware of that all along, you know, and I never felt like I needed that extra boost, you know. For me, spending months, weeks, or even days in the nature meditating has been more than satisfactory. But as as someone who's committed to moving the ball forward, of course, I felt obliged to at least explore that. And I had a good fortune to experience it in a kind of a, you know, the thing about ayahuasca and stuff is, like, people who are familiar with that, you know, you get sick. It's a long thing. It's like a weekend long sort of commitment, you know, and it has all these stages and stuff. Well, I didn't do that, and I've not done that. And maybe someday I would, but I would want to be that. I would want to do that in an authentic way. And instead, I had the good fortune of doing, of experiencing something called 5-MeO-DMT, which is from the venom of the Sonoran desert toad. And the whole experience lasted like about 12 minutes, you know. But it was completely, that 12 minutes for me was like, experienced like an eternity, you know, like William Blake's sort of eternity in an hour, in 12 minutes. And it was the most profound experience I ever had. And it definitely is part of the reason that I realized that speaking about climate trauma was kind of a clinical way of speaking about something that's actually much more, that's not very clinical, is actually much more realistic and personal. And that's, you know, Gaia's trauma. Biospheric trauma is a more scientific way. Like climate trauma, you know, to me, that it's an accurate term. It gets people's attention. Scientifically, biospheric trauma overcomes a lot of people's resistance. But really, it is Gaia's trauma, and we're starting to awaken to that. And I think that is a game changer.
Yeah, and you know, a couple of months ago, you had emailed me about a conference or an online webinar on trauma that really, really captured your interest. And I'd like you to say a little bit more about that, if you would, and tell us, you know, if you know how people might be able to get hold of those recordings, or is there a website where we can find pieces of that event?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, that quote that you started the show out with was from Thomas Hubel.
Uh-huh.
And he's a really interesting, charismatic, spiritual teacher.
May I just say that quote again? It's just one sentence. He says, "We are swimming in the soup of a collectively traumatized humanity."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he organized this online symposium, which happened over a course of 9 days. I think there ended up being 29 speakers, actually.
Uh-huh.
He's a really interesting character. I think I encourage people. So people should go to his website, Thomas Hubel, H-U-B-L. They will find... they should find links there to the Collective Trauma Summit library. There's a whole library of the presentations. But if people are interested, I would also encourage them to go to YouTube and find the closing panels discussion from the symposium. It's about an hour and a half long, I think. But it's really illuminating and some really interesting dialogue in there, and it'll give you a really good taste of what you know, what is available in more depth in the library.
I wonder if we could say one more time the man's name and his website.
Well, his name is Tomas, spelled like Thomas, Hubel, H-U-B, as in boy, L, Hubel. He's Austrian, and that's his website is thomashubel.com. Or,
okay. You know,
he has a...
Thank you.
And he has a nonprofit called the Pocket Project, which is addressing collective trauma around the world. But I just wanted to start by noting that he comes from a spiritual background. He was in medical school, and I think he was going to become a psychiatrist, but he just kind of walked away from it. He just thought it was inadequate to the task, and went on an extended spiritual retreat, I think 4-year retreat. And it was coming from that where he came out of that and started doing spiritual retreats with people to resolve their traumas. That's what he felt called to do. And it was in that experience that he found that there was always a collective element of trauma that was blocking people's ability to deal with their own trauma or creating dissonance.
Yeah.
And so he became very much in tune to that. And he was dealing in small and large groups with people that were from Germany and Israel, and so Germans and Jews, and they realized quickly what the collective trauma was. So one of the most horrific collective traumas, the Shoah, the Holocaust, and that's where his experience. So he's kind of comes out of the fire, you know, and he was sort of tuned into the climate trauma angle by Terry Patton. Uh-huh. And Terry Patton has been working with Thomas Hubel to broaden his audience, get his message out there to the larger community. And Terry read my paper, I guess, when it was first published. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the sort of catalysts for organizing this collective trauma summit.
Good.
Did I sort of answer the question? I'm not sure what the question was.
Yeah, you did. No, that's fine. And I think it's important for people to know this website of Thomas Hubel, and, you know, just kind of explore around there and see if you can get, you know, links to some of these recordings, because there were some amazing, phenomenal people at this conference. And, you know, it speaks so closely to what is really up for us now. And I'd like to, Jiwa, I'd like to now go to talking about Gaia, her trauma, and how do we develop a deeper and more intimate relationship with Gaia?
Can I just footnote that?
Sure.
First, I just want people to know that the summit was dealing with trauma at all levels, like personal,
yes,
a lot of epigenetic or generational trauma, you know, what we've learned about trauma, sort of the state of knowledge on trauma, what we know about it, like from medicine and science and blah, blah, blah. And, but also like, there were really powerful Native American voices and Jewish. So they were dealing with, genocide, and, there was, African Americans like Reverend Kyoto Williams dealing with slavery. So it covered the whole spectrum. I just don't want people to have the idea that it was just about, you know, climate trauma.
Not at all. Thank you for the clarification.
Okay. Yeah. So thanks for letting me get that in. So yeah, let me get started. I wanted to share something with you this morning. It's from the Parabola winter issue, the most recent issue on the theme of the goddess. I love Parabola magazine. That's a really good thing. But there's
it's Parabola, P-A-R-A-B-O-L-E-O-L. Let me say it again. P-A-R-A-B-O-L-A magazine, which you can find online.
Yeah, yeah. And there's an article or interview in here with African healer and guide Baba Mandaza Augustine Kademwa on Earth as Goddess. And I just wanted to share his perspective really quick because it's very much congruent with my own, but he's coming from a much more traditional unbroken lineage. And he says, humanity has forgotten where we came from. Mother Earth is the giver of everything. And he makes the most, I think, a really critical point for those of us who are involved in trying to resolve the climate crisis, which is we cannot heal Mother Earth. She heals herself. She is the one who can heal us.
Uh-huh.
And to me, that's a critical point that we have not yet. We're still in this sort of scientific materialist paradigm of thinking we can fix it, you know, we're going to fix it. And, you know, the idea that of creating technology that can draw carbon out of the atmosphere, for instance, you know, is silly because nature has ways of doing that are far more efficient. But nonetheless, you have millions and millions of dollars being spent by people trying to create the perfect mousetrap or something, you know, like that's going to solve the climate crisis. But it's only, and I think we're this close to this realization, and it's going to come to the forefront this year with the International Biodiversity Conventions. We have to stop. We have to stop thinking of ourselves as victims of the climate, you know, like somehow we're being victimized, and come into proper relationship with the earth as a living organism, which is science. It's not really religion, although it invokes religious feeling, but there's solid science there for that. And basically look to Gaia for guidance and ask her, what can we do to help facilitate the healing process? And if we do that, then it opens up an immense amount of possibility and potential. And that is exactly what is going to be considered in October of this year in China, when the countries come together to renew the International Biodiversity Conventions.
If there is not a pandemic that keeps people away from China.
Yeah, well, hopefully they'll resolve that between now and then. But, you know, they can always change the location. but that just shows the urgency of what's going on and why you can't, we can't control. Yeah, we just have so much hubris in the way we approach the whole climate thing, you know, like it is about us. We have to, but it's not about us. It's really about our relations and our relationship to the natural world. And that means recognizing and acknowledging our relationship to the earth as a living organism. And I think we've been really slow to come around to that. Mm-hmm. In the same way we've been really slow to come around to the idea of quantum reality. You know, it's like when Copernicus said, you know, guess what? The earth revolves around the sun, not the other way around. It wasn't like everybody immediately stopped saying, oh, the earth is rising. Right. I mean, the sun is rising in the east. And we're still saying that, you know, takes us a long time before these ideas really change the way we relate to things.
Right.
And so that's happening, and we need to focus on that. And I think, you know, the power in of awareness, of acknowledging this is what's happening, and because it requires, and I really think, you know, I wrote a essay more recently on the taboo in talking about this idea with people in the movement. I noticed like resistances, you know, there's a lot of, there's different kinds of resistances. And so I wrote an article about the taboos of this involved here. And one of them is simply that idea of hubris and the idea that it's all about us, because when you recognize that the earth is a living organism, then it requires you to see yourself as merely a cell in that organism.
Yes.
And that's a very humbling, that's sort of the antidote to hubris, you know, that's a very humbling kind of realization that, you know what, I'm just kind of a cell in the gut of this big organism. And I'm causing her to be very ill. I'm raising her temperature to the point where her organs are starting to shut down. And I need to activate myself, you know, as William Ury said in the conference, I need to see myself as part of her immune defense system and become activated as a cell in her immune defense system. Mm-hmm. And even that is, even that idea is very, actually, it's like, it's not all about me, you know,
right?
Because the immune defense system is something that, like birds in flight, you know, it kind of, it all gets activated and it all is acting in a coordinated way without one cell necessarily being aware of a cell on the other, you know, somewhere in your foot or whatever, you know, in the system. So it's a different way of thinking about it, but I think it's a much more natural, congruent way. And once we really come into proper relationship and start acknowledging Gaia, the earth as a living, breathing, heartbeat, you know, organism, it responds. She responds, you know. She'll respond in ways that we can't even imagine right now. So I think it's, given the dire circumstances that we're in, it's exactly the kind of medicine that we need, because what we're doing is not working, right?
Exactly. Well, the last question I want to ask you has to do with deep time. Joanna Macy, as well as other luminaries, talk about deep time. That is a way of looking at time in the larger, broader perspective, rather than in terms of 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And in that larger perspective, it may be that from the ashes of what is being destroyed in this planet will evolve unimaginable possibilities, perhaps even a new species in hundreds of thousands or millions of years, maybe even a new human species. Talking about quantum possibilities, do you have any thoughts on that?
No. Yeah, a lot of thoughts on that. Me, so I try to organize them a little bit.
Sure.
So the issue of time is really important, because, and this is actually something I learned more completely from some of the speakers in the summit, but trauma distorts our sense of time.
Uh-huh.
It disrupts our sense of time. And, you know, when we have a traumatic experience, sometimes they speak about it becoming frozen in time, you know.
Right.
But it also, and this is the part I was aware of that, but also it distorts the way we experience time. And so we think things are going faster than maybe they are,
mm-hmm.
which is really interesting idea, because my whole life I've thought I've had the sense of time speeding up,
mm-hmm.
not just from getting old, but even from when I was much younger. I thought it just seems like things are happening quicker and quicker, like time is speeding up. Like we don't have, you know, we don't really have an objective way of measuring that. We don't know if that crystal that oscillates in a vault in London or wherever, Greenwich, it's itself speeding up, you know, We just assume that it's a steady state thing. But, you know, if you think about it, so when we're experiencing trauma, we get panicky. So yeah, when we're in a panic mode, we feel like we have to act, you know. And and one of the brilliant insights that Thomas Huber brings to traumatology is that the appropriate response to that sense that we have to do things quicker and speed is actually to slow down. He says, if you can slow your mind down, then the truth has a chance to emerge, which is a really beautiful way of talking about meditation.
Yes.
But also in the moment, if we can like get control of our breath, you know, and deepen our, you know, because when time is speeding up on us and we're panicking, our breath shortens, you know, so we can, you know, somatically focus just on deepening our breath and it'll start slowing our mind down and give the truth a chance. So that's like an individual level, but certainly if we are experiencing trauma at a biospheric level and at the planetary level, then actually it does make sense that it feels like time is speeding up and we have less, you know, we have less and less in time to act. And, you know, and I mean, scientifically, I think, yeah, that's true. The scientists have told us we have 10 years basically now to take drastic action to avoid the worst consequences of climate catastrophe. But, you know, that's a projection. And so maybe they are experiencing, I mean, scientists are traumatized too, you know, climate scientists are traumatized. So maybe we actually have a little more time than that, but it's good to err on the side of caution.
Right.
So I wanted to sort of start by addressing that, the idea that that time itself is a distortion or is distorted by trauma. But on the issue of deep time, before, you know, as a bridge to that, one thing I recognize is, I don't know if this is like a necessary human survival thing that we're hardwired to do or whatever, but everybody has an opinion about what's going to happen. Everybody is an expert, you know, like, one of those psychologists, I remember, one of the theoretical psychologists said, we're all our own psychologists, you know, we're all our own scientists, we're always doing trial and error, that kind of thing. So everybody has an opinion on the future with climate trauma. And what I have come to recognize over time, and it's very congruent with what I've experienced in my lifetime in in eco-activism, is that there's this broad spectrum, and everybody falls along that spectrum, right? And in the environmental movement, I've always felt like, and I'm kind of on one end of the spectrum, and the other end of the spectrum is more conservative people, and there's people in the middle, and I've always had an appreciation for the spectrum. Like, you need all of those parts, you know? But what's interesting with predicting the future of the planet in relation to human activity is that pretty much everybody I talk to has that opinion about what's going to happen. And obviously, not everybody can be correct. But everybody's pretty convinced they have their reasons, you know. And I refuse to engage in that very much, you know, because I just have such a deep appreciation for not knowing. Mm-hmm. And this comes from spiritual practice and Buddhist in particular, but I recognize that most people, non-Buddhists in particular, have a real problem with the idea of not knowing. Like, when they get a diagnosis from the doctor, they want to know how much time they have left, you know, and all this. Like, we're very attached to this whole timeline, and we all want to know how the story ends.
Yeah,
it's almost like that is, you know, something our parents gave us or something, you know. Like, we all are entitled to know how the story ends. And the truth of the matter is we don't know. You know, we have to do our best. And I feel like it becomes a real distraction, actually, from focusing on what's happening. You know, kind of like with this whole impeachment thing, like nobody's talking about the dismantling of the environmental regulations in this community because impeachment, you know, like, so is that really a great thing that, you know, like, I mean, is it necessary? Yeah, I suppose. But does it have to be so darn distracting, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing, it's natural to try to imagine what our future scenarios are. And it's necessary to realize, of course, that we're facing an existential threat and that we have to take action now for future generations and for a future to be possible. But that's about as far as we need to go. And, you know, beyond that, it becomes more of the same. It becomes more about, you know, I'm right and you're wrong, you know, and all you people are just so, are so in denial or so, you know, ignorant, or you don't, you know, I mean, that's our political, that's sort of the trauma sphere we're inhabiting. And it's not very conducive to, birthing a new species. And so then finally, you know, getting to the other side of that bridge and your original question, I have sensed since I first started writing about this in Planetary Hospice that what we are witnessing is actual transmutation of the human species into something else. And I think that's happening in part because of exponential growth, exponential population growth, and in the sort of new radical interconnectivity of human beings, like what we are doing right now, would not have been possible 20 years ago, right. You know. The advent of the internet and then soon to be quantum technology with the internet, you know, we are definitely becoming a different species. And what the climate crisis is forcing, the issue that the climate crisis is forcing us to address in that process is what is human nature and what is our relationship to the natural world? Because if we don't get that right, we're going to cease being human. And, you know, we're going to become artificial intelligence or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think anybody really wants, you know, that's one of our great fears, is a world taken over by robots and artificial intelligence that has no place for humans. You know, that's a very common theme in science fiction these days. And so we don't want that to happen. We want to return to the garden somehow, you know? That's really, again, it kind of comes down to this religious idea that we have this idea of the story that we originally inhabited a Garden of Eden in the West, anyhow. That story is about our relationship with the natural world. And we were expelled from the garden, you know, and somehow we're trying to get back to the garden, you know, and that has to have a very central place in this transmutation of the human species that we're undergoing. Mm-hmm. And part of that transmutation also is that because of the interconnectivity, not just human to human, but human to Earth and human to every other living thing on the planet, we're having a profound influence on what species survive and which species do not. Mm-hmm. And that is part of our makeup of who we are. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a kind of responsibility that you never really want to have, but it's being forced upon us to decide like who not just who we are as humans, but who we are in relationship with, which species survive and which ones do not. And that decision is being made every day.
And what's also curious, I'm working on this book with Andrew Harvey right now called Radical Regeneration, Birthing a New Human Species in the Age of Extinction.
Yeah, I love that title. That's just really profound.
Thank you. And doing some research for the book, I discovered in 2018, the British Museum of Natural History reported that 280 species that year had been new species had been discovered.
Discovered, yeah.
Yeah.
And not born, not new species in the sense that they didn't exist before, though, right?
Yeah. which is amazing, that even in this time of mass extinction, we're seeing, the coming forth of new species.
I have a friend who's one of the world's leading mycologists. He studies mushrooms, and he's a great guy. And he takes people down to South America every winter, and then up to Alaska in the summer, and cataloging new species of mushroom. They go into the and like they do 10 or 15 a day, There's just like there's like so many different mushrooms out there that haven't been cataloged. So what that shows is that when you start to lose something, you appreciate it more, And so we're really this is forcing us to really appreciate the diversity of life on planet Earth and how it all works together, which is all very recent knowledge for us. And we're still sort of discovering. I don't know about you, but like when I watch these David Attenborough series, I'm just like, my jaw is down here, Like, oh, you really got it. This is like so amazing how species, the web of life is just so intricate.
Yeah.
It's so incredibly like a Swiss watch or something, the way things work in nature, that it inspires awe. And that is the, because Gaia is ill, because she can see or is aware of, the special role that humans have or in her health and well-being, it's incumbent on her to get our attention. Mm-hmm. And so she has, just like those David Attenborough series, she has these amazing ways of getting our attention. And I think that's where entheogenic substances sort of come in, these plants, that have always been there and have always been used by indigenous peoples,
right,
to communicate with her. Mm-hmm. They're starting now, there's like a thirst almost, in people on the West Coast, I know, to experience these things. Mm-hmm. And to me, they might just think it's, their own curiosity or their experience with drugs in their youth, and they're wondering what this is about. But it's actually Gaia saying, come, look, feel this, And then when you have that type of an experience, you're like, wow, I have to do something. So this is what William Ury was talking about with Gaia's immunodefense system activating itself, and we're all these sort of sleeper cells in her immunodefense system that are being activated through awareness. Once we come into awareness that, oh my goodness, I have this, I'm part of this larger whole.
Yeah.
Right? And a larger whole implies healing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And this larger whole is ill. And so I'm part of the healing process. Mm-hmm. And so I need, people are like, what can I do, And are becoming activated and hopefully this year enough so, and we certainly see it with the youth, you know, the Sunrise Movement, to create the kind of change systemically and throughout society and culture to be able to overcome Gaia's trauma.
Well, we're coming down to the end of our time, Jiwa, and I wonder if you have any other thoughts beyond what you've already shared with us so beautifully this morning.
You know, I intentionally came to this without any, without other than that quote from the African shaman, you know, healer. I think that, yeah, we are at that critical pivot point. I think especially like today, as we're recording this, you know, Trump's going to be getting acquitted. Mm-hmm. Democracy kind of as we know it is ending. And the Democratic establishment is freaking out because there's this insurgent candidate who wants to change everything that has all this energy behind him. This is, we're going to look back someday at this year and realize that, that was the turning point one way or another. Because either, you know, that insurgency that is so necessary is going to succeed, and we're going to see, you know, last year was, you know, kind of with the article in the New Yorker magazine and so forth. Last year was very much the year that people really became aware and awake to the extent of the crisis. We reached some sort of critical mass where popular culture became really aware of the gravity of the situation. And this is the year that we need to activate that awareness into systemic change. And it has to happen now because it's already too late. And, you know, we're already looking at probably 2 degrees Celsius, and we need to somehow cut our losses, you know, and mitigate the damage that we're causing for the future. And I think all the sort of things are in play for that to happen, with the Green New Deal, with the Bernie insurgency, with the international biodiversity conventions coming up in October. I'm an archetypal astrologer, so I'll say, with Saturn and Pluto doing their dance and Jupiter coming into play, you know, like it's a very interesting time astrologically. Something's happening here. And a year from now, we'll know what that was, you know, and we'll either be fleeing to India and, you know, like either I'm going to be retreating to a cave for the rest of my life, or we're going to actually be rolling up our sleeves and enlisting Gaia in our effort to heal the planet. And so I think it's not about being optimist or pessimist. I like that was William Urey as well, who says William Urey is this from Harvard School of Negotiation, and he's on the front line of the world's most intractable conflicts. And he says, I'm never an optimist or a pessimist. I'm a possibilist. You know, that it's about what is possible. And I think that's the sentiment that I share. Mm-hmm. And then I did have one other piece that I wanted to share with you and the listeners from the conference, and that's a quote from Gabor Maté.
Yes.
And he says, now, what you see regularly in nature, no animal will foul their own nest. Mm-hmm. So the climate crisis is an example of just how denatured we've become, really separated from our own true nature, because no animal in the state of nature will destroy their own habitat. That is where we find ourselves, and that is why I have been sort of advocating for human nature as a solution to the climate crisis, that once we remember how to reconnect with our own true selves, which is human nature, then that relationship with our own nature allows us collectively, once we reach a critical mass of people acknowledging human nature, coming into congruence with their higher selves, then we will recover human nature collectively, and then we'll be able to come into relationship with our mother, the natural world. And that is what the crisis is all about. That's why we're experiencing this crisis, because we fell out of that relationship for whatever reasons. We don't, have to go into great length on that, but we're not in proper relationship with our own human nature or with the natural world. And thus this crisis is necessary, all we can do is focus on proper relationships, because that's how you resolve trauma.
And so if none of those positive possibilities happen, you'll be heading for a cave in India?
Yeah.
Okay. I may join you there.
I think that's where my last life ended, so I'll go pick up the thread.
Okay. Because I don't think any of that's going to happen. And that's okay that I don't think so. But it'd be nice to join you at a cave in India.
we'll just have to vibrate to a higher frequency. It's a big universe.
Ziwa, thank you again so much for being with us today. I love the work you're doing, and thank you for reminding us of how critically important it is to intimately reconnect with Gaia. If you'd like to contact Ziwa, you can do so at ziwa.woodbury@gmail.com. And again, Ziwa is spelled Z-H-I-W-A, then .woodbury@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Carolyn Baker asking you to serve Gaia and all living beings.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.